For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Great to be back, Monday night. All right, let's continue in our series. It's been a real treat the first couple of weeks. We've had Rabbi Vero Wein, Rabbi Emanuel Feldman, Rabbi Michael Berger. It's been quite a lineup as we've begun our courses. Tonight's class, truth be told, is really about cholent. It just is. Because many of you have always wondered, why is there such a big deal about cholent amongst the Jewish people? And there is an answer to that question. Why is cholent such a big deal amongst the Jewish people? Why is it that no matter where in the world you go, Jews have some type of cholent? And that is the course of, that is the topic of tonight's discussion. The context in which I'm going to discuss cholent is going to be a group called the Karaites, the Karaim. And eventually we will get back to that. The Karaim, the Hebrew word is karaim, comes from the word kra. Kra is from the word mikra, like a verse, scripture, meaning a simple reading of the Chumash itself, as we'll see. In English, they're referred to as Karaites. And that is a group that developed in the 8th century, and that's going to be what we will be talking about tonight. If you have on your chart, your timeline in your notebooks, if you want to take that out just for a second, I just want to give you the context as to where we are speaking. This is going to be the last class before we get to the period that we'll be a little bit more familiar with. By the time we get to next week, we're going to be discussing the division of the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim as the Jews leave Babylonia and move in about the year 1000 to various different lands. And that's going to become a little bit more familiar to us, historically speaking, as we hit the personalities of Rashi, the Ramban, Tonight's class is going to take place between the years 600 and 1000. So we've crossed over from the Hanukkah story, which was discussed last week, which was already before the turn of the Common Era. We're now post Common Era. We're going to be in about the years 600 to 1000. So if you just want to get a sense on your timeline where we are, on the orange, on the top half of your sheet, you'll see the different listings. You'll see the Hillel and Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Akiva and the Tanaic era around the year. It's hard to point out exactly where I am, but I'm towards the right-hand side of the page. And you see where the word Mishnah is on the first, in the pictures on that first line, following the destruction of the Second Temple. We are in that period between the Tanaim, Amoraim, and then you see the Savaraic transition period, and then the Gaonic era. Anyone see where I am? Moving across the orange. That's the area that we are, which is, if you look right below that, the various pictures, we're post-destruction of the First Temple, post-destruction of the Second Temple, to the Mishnah, Babylonian, Talmud era. That's where we are historically. If you want to just refer to that, just have a sense as to where we are. Now, because the Karaim is one of the major controversies which takes place within Jewish history, and it actually continues today, there are still Karaite communities that exist in the world. There were those that have existed continuously since this time that we're going to learn about. So there are actually websites discussing them because they're real people that exist today. There's one Karaite shul in the U.S. It's in California. If you go, and like I did as I was researching this, to various websites, so there's one is Karaite.org, the Karaite Corner. There are various different websites which actually describe their own history in their own words and their own sets of beliefs, which is very interesting to read. The one that I went on to, Karaites.org, so on the opening of your sheet, you have a little box there, which is the opening line when you click onto the website. This is what hits you as you first learn about the Karaite movement, and that is, search the scripture well, and do not rely on anyone's opinion. That defines the Karaite movement. That's the first thing you see when you click onto their website. Search scripture well, but don't rely or trust anyone's opinion. You read it well. And what you think it means, so means it. And that's going to be, as we're going to learn, well, what are the differences between traditional rabbinic Judaism, which we are part of, and this Karaite movement? They believe they are the true Jews. They believe we are following scripture as it is. You read it, you understand what it means, and you don't allow the rabbis of the Talmud to tell you what it means. You read it, understand it, and then follow what it says based on simply a reading of the Chumash. That's why they're called Karoyim in Hebrew. Again, Mikra, they simply read the words of the Chumash and they disregard everything else. Now, the movement itself developed, as we will learn from its origins until what it is today. It has gone through a dynamic process of sorts, and we will go through various aspects of them and what it is that they believe along the way. How is the sound, by the way?
Good.
So far, so good?
Too loud?
No, seriously, is it too loud?
No,
you want to just move back? Okay, so let's begin. This group begins in the 8th century, in the 700s, as a Jewish, we refer to them as a heretical sect. I say that in very, like, we believe, Torah Judaism believes it's a heretical sect. They believe they are the true Jews. They believe they are holders of the true tradition from Sinai, despite the fact that we look at them as a heretical sect, which is an interesting thing to go as you read and you learn about them, that dynamic that takes place. What we will see is when they will take over 40% of the Jewish world and a community is split between rabbinic Jews and Karaitic, whatever the right way of saying that would be, Jews, they are each fighting for what they believe is the supremacy, the true tradition, as to what does the Torah indeed want. But we believe them to be a heretical sect. They profess their religious observances and opinions, following only the Chumash, the five books of Moshe, to the exclusion of the corrupting and non-divine rabbinical traditions and laws. What this is going to come down to, we're going to discuss this at length, is the belief that Torah Judaism has had from the time that Moshe came down from Sinai is there were two Torahs given, two parts of the Torah, two halves, a written tradition, which we refer to as our Chumash, the five books of Moshe, and then there's an oral tradition. For anyone who has actually studied the Chumash in depth will come to the realization immediately, it is impossible to derive a religion out of the written work alone. It can't be. There's too much blank spaces, too many things that don't make sense. Place these totafos between your eyes. What are totafos? What are they that I need to place on my arm and between my eyes? Place these fringes. What do those look like? If you don't keep Shabbos, you deserve death. Well, what does Shabbos look like? Very, almost nothing. One mitzvah after another, slaughter animals as I have commanded you. Well, you flip from the beginning to the end, it doesn't say anywhere. Where's the follow-up of as the eye of command? Numerous statements of an indication that there is an oral law and explanation which comes together. In the words of Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, who we studied in our great books course last year, who was the 19th century German leader. In his words, the way that it was set up is someone who went to a lecture, and a person is sitting at the lecture and he's taking notes on the professor's words, and say, when you're taking notes, you write shorthanded. You write quickly, you make little arrows or dots, all sorts of mechanisms to remind you of what it is that the professor was saying. The one who was at the lecture, who then reads the notes, he understands everything that's there, what it means, what the line meant, why I underlined this, why I drew an arrow there, what that shorthanded, it wasn't a full sentence, because I was at the lecture. These notes remind me of the way the system is in its full. If I hand my notes to somebody who wasn't at the lecture and say, here you go, they'll read that and it will look like gibberish. There's not enough information in it. And that's the paradigm that Rav Hirsch uses to explain the relationship between the oral law and the written law. We have a written law. It's just incomplete. It simply is. You can't read it alone. And the oral law comes together to explain, expound, and we'll talk a little bit more about this as the evening goes. This sect of the Karaites, the Karaim, as we'll see, denied the divine element of the oral law. It is an explanation, but it's not the explanation. And therefore, we're not bound by it. The rabbis have made this up. In fact, they have corrupted the purity of the written word by adding all sorts of explanations to it to change, define, shape what it is. But it's no longer the pure written word of Moshe from Hashem. We believe it came directly from God to Moses on Sinai, and you've corrupted it, say the Karaites to Rabbinic Judaism. Rabbinic Judaism looks at them and says, no, these two are a partnership. They come together. This is what's kept us all of these years. And from here, the the controversy, so to speak. The two different sects will go off in their own different ways. They are going to begin in their origins, this movement, as a very literal translation, and it will not work. And what's going to happen in centuries following its origin, the Karaites themselves will adopt various ways of interpretation to make it more feasible. But it did spread, and eventually has, right now there are very few, a few minor communities here or there. It's impossible, by the way, to know exactly how many there are, because the Torah says you're not permitted to count Jews. So since the Torah says you're not permitted to count Jews, so we do, not one, not two, not three, or we count half shekels, they don't count. So we really don't know how many Karaites are in the world. The numbers range from the maximum to about 40,000. There are some numbers that put it much lower, 800. Unclear. There are a few communities in Israel still today that are Karaite communities. When the modern state of Israel was founded, it was a discussion again as to whether or not they should be considered Jews or not. Hitler decided and decreed that they were Jews, and they were sent to the gas chambers in the same way as all of our Jewish brethren were as well. But they've existed in communities throughout, from this time that they began in the 7th century until today. They still exist. There's a community I mentioned in California, and there are a couple of communities still in Eretz Yisrael. The reason why we're studying them, even though there's such a minority opinion right now as to, there was an article in the New York Times in September 3rd, somebody forwarded it to me. They said, I saw your list of topics. I see you're teaching the Karaites. The New York Times ran an article on September 3rd about the Karaite community in Israel as it's trying to reestablish itself and all the difficulties they have in the land of Israel. You can imagine all the difficulties in Israel between getting married and divorced and all the rituals that go on in Israel, and you have the rabbinic government being run by the rabbis. Look at them as, you know, that you survived is amazing, but you're not Jewish. And all the difficulties that they've had with that. And so there's a whole write-up in the New York Times about that even recently. Why are we spending time studying them tonight? Because it's very important to recognize a couple of things about this time period. Number one, what were the social and political elements in place that allowed them to flourish? There's much for us to learn about what took place when they began, how they took off, what was going on around that time period. And number two, what was the rabbinic response to all of their claims? Because we live a life, our daily life, the air we breathe is based on the tradition from Sinai of the oral law. What's the response to their claim that says, indeed, we are the holders of the Mesorah, we are the holders of the tradition, we are the descendants of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, following the Torah in the way that it was meant to be followed? There is a group that claimed that we're wrong. It would seem that just based on our numbers, history would have said, we are right. We believe that we're right. This group, alive and well today, would say to us in this room, we, the small numbers of holdouts, are the ones waiting for the Messiah to come in order to redeem the Jewish people, because we are the true Jews. So it's not even just a controversy which once existed, like the Sadducees, which are very similar, that they're gone. There are no Sadducees today. There are Karaite communities today who you might run into who claim that they are indeed the true Jews. So it's still as we've said throughout all of these classes, everything that we've dealt with in the past, we continue to deal with, sometimes with literally the same names and sometimes in different formats. But this is something which took place, and let's learn about it a little bit. Okay, so let's take a look at the political background as to that which is going on during this time. Jews arrive in Babylonia prior to the first destruction, before the first base of Mikdash is destroyed. We're going back to the year 586, before the Common Era. The Jews have gotten to the land of Israel. Shlomo HaMelech builds the Beis HaMikdash. It stands for just over 400 years before its destruction. The Jews are already exiled, a good chunk of them, to Babylonia, where they're going to establish the community. That community, which is established prior to the destruction, is what's going to save the Jewish people. Because when the destruction happens and the masses are exiled, what they find in Babylonia is an already established community with yeshivas, schools, mikvahs, butchers, kosher shops. Total opposite of what happened here in America, where when the masses came over, we weren't ready for them. And it took us a generation or two to get ourselves ready. When the Navi already describes that before the exile, 11 years prior to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, Hashem sent a lot of the leaders. They were exiled in a separate incident. They get to Babylonia, they establish community. So when the masses come after the destruction, the community is ready to absorb based on everything that they need in the community. But in any case, I stress this because it's an old community. That community in Babylonia, which is going to be the heart of the Jewish people, exists until the destruction of the Second Temple, which is in the year 70 following the Common Era, which we're talking over 600 years. Even when the Second Temple is rebuilt, the majority of Jews don't leave Babylonia. They stay there, even in while the land of Israel is reestablished, even when the Second Temple stands, even when the Hanukkah story takes place. There is a constant community in the land of Babylonia in Babel during all that time. And then following the second destruction in the year 70, the Jews, the remnants of the Jews, many of them in Israel are exiled. They go back to Babylon, where there's still a community, and that community will exist for another 1,000 years. Until the Jews finally disperse out of there and will create what we know as the lands of Ashkenaz and Sfard. That's where they are. It's a strong, well-established community. Now, following the destruction of the temple in the year 70, many Jews remain in Israel and they fight the Romans, they revolt against the Romans. We have, of course, the famous Bar Kokhba revolt, which we are not going to be discussing at length, but that's about in the year 140, which is about 70 years after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Bar Kokhba comes along and says, we're going to rebuild the temple, he's going to be the Messiah, the revolt is crushed, there are a series of other rebellions which are crushed, and the remnant of the Jewish people in Israel are basically sent packing. It's a terrible time for the Jews in the land of Israel. What happens then, and around this time, is one of the most significant events in Jewish history, and that is that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, sees the destruction that's taken place, the persecutions, and realizes that the tradition of the oral law, which has existed in that sense, in an oral tradition from the time of Mount Sinai for the last 700 to 1,000 years, is going to be lost because of the persecutions and the destruction and the dispersion of the Jews. So Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi sets out to establish what we know as the Mishnah, which is a compilation of all of the teachings of the oral law. They had been taught before, but they were always taught orally. And Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi sets out to compile them in a book that's considered... Now this is a big deal because it's an oral law, and he is compiling it and writing it down. But Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi sees that without that it will be lost. The crushing defeat of all of the rebellions, the destruction of the Second Temple, which has happened 70 years prior, necessitates it being written down, and he writes down what's known as the Mishnah, and that is concluded in about the year 200 in the Common Era. So just to give you a sense, so we're about 180 to the year 200, that's where the Mishnah is then set out and redacted. Then we have the discussions of the Mishnah in the Talmud. There are now two communities, remember. We have a small community in Israel still. It's a community that's already suffered the second destruction. It's a community that suffered the Bar Kokhba revolt and it's being crushed. But the bulk of the Jews are in Babylonia. And they now, each one of them gets hold of the Mishnah and begins its discussion. And that's what's known as the Amoraim. If you want to just see back to your yellow charts, this is the Amoraic era. After the Mishnah is completed, then the next generation of sages, the Amoraim, discuss it both in Jerusalem and in Babylonia. The Jerusalem discussions last only about 100 years, till about 150 years, till about the year 350, and then the Jews are completely exiled, and that's the completion of the Jerusalem Talmud. You've heard of the two Talmuds, right? The Jerusalem Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud. The Jerusalem Talmud is finished in about the year 350. It's not completed, it was never edited. The Jews were just exiled. It is as it is. It does not contain nearly as much, it's not nearly as large as the Babylonian Talmud. And the remnants of the Jews go to Babylonia, and there they, for the next 200-300 years, continue discussing, debating, clarifying the Mishnah in what becomes known as the Babylonian Talmud. And that's why the Babylonian Talmud takes precedence over the Jerusalem Talmud, because the Babylonian Talmud had the Jerusalem Talmud plus an extra 200 years of discussion. And then the Babylonian Talmud is completed, sealed, and edited, so that by the year 500 to 600, we now have a complete set of the Talmud, which is now the repository of the oral law. Why am I spending so much time going through this? I hope you find it interesting. I do, but maybe you don't. Because we now have, for the first time in Jewish history, about this time, the year 500 to 600, a written work that personifies and is the oral law. So now there's an actual book where if you have a question, how do I do this, how do I do that, it's in the book. It's been written down. We actually now have the Talmud. What's going to happen is it's going to be edited over the next couple hundred years, from 600 to 1,000, and then we begin Rashi already. Rashi is already just a few hundred years after this, who's now beginning to take this written down work and is going to begin to expound upon it, is going to begin to explain it, to begin to elucidate it. We're going to have the Ramban, Nachmanides, Maimonides, and then all the commentators. This is where we are in the historical period. So when we're going to have a group that says, wait a minute, we don't buy this book. This book that you're giving me, this book that you're claiming is from Sinai, the reality is, how old is the book? So it depends on how you look at it. Right? The actual book in a printed, written form, there wasn't a printing press, obviously, but the actual written book is brand new. We're going to talk about this group, the Karaites, are going to develop in the late 600s. That's less than 100 years after we actually now have a Talmud. So if there's going to be a group that's going to come and say, that's not divine, the rabbis made that up, this is a time period that's ripe for that. And that's where we are, historically speaking, in Babylonia, in the time period of the development of the Oral Law. Now, the Oral Law wasn't actually new in the year 600, it was only written down in the year 600. It existed for 1,500 years in the form that it had. It just was oral, from the time that Moshe comes down from Har Sinai, all the way through the times of the Jews in the land of Israel, during the first Beis HaMikdash, and Shlomo HaMelech, and the second, but it was just written down and sealed as the Babylonian Talmud, in which point you can no longer add to it. Even today, the way we deal with it, we comment on the Babylonian Talmud, we don't add to it. There's a significant period in Jewish history where the oral law has now, so to speak, been sealed into the Talmud. Everything after that is commenting on it, but in itself is sealed, which is going to create the context for a group to be able to say, why? Why can't I say something still? Why can't I claim this is the correct interpretation? But that is a little bit of a historical context. Now, two other major points that are going to create the context of what it is that we're discussing. In Babylonia, there were two major yeshivas. This is already established, the Babylonian community is 1,500 years old. But as it developed, there was a yeshiva in Sura and a yeshiva in Pumbedisa. Two major places are quoted all the time in the Gemara. They both had a head. We would call it today a Rosh Yeshiva. In that time, it was called a Gaon. So there were Gaonim in plural. There was the Gaon of Sura, and there was the Gaon of Pumbedisa. It was, again, what we would call the Rosh Yeshiva. But that was a very powerful position. If you were the heads of either one of these two yeshivas, you were basically running the Jewish community. You were running the spiritual life of what existed in Babylonia. And the two of them would, so to speak, share it. If they were both very strong personalities, they would share it equally. If one was stronger than the other, you know how politics go. But there were two heads of the yeshiva, and they were basically in charge of the spiritual life of the Babylonian Jewish community. And those yeshivas maintained themselves for many, many hundreds of years, all the way to the time period that we're talking about, 400, 500, 600. What was fascinating about the Babylonian community, which was run by the Persians at this time, is that they set up a independent Jewish government for the Babylonian Jews. The person in charge of that was known as the Resh Galusa, which is an Aramaic, would literally translate as the head of the exile, and in English it was the exilarch. The exilarch was appointed by the at this point, either by the Persians, and then it was established as well by the Muslims when they come in the middle of the 7th century. The exilarch ran the independent Jewish world of Babylonia. So it was a fascinating existence in Babylonia, in which you have a long-standing Jewish community. You have two heads of the yeshivas who ran the spiritual world. And from a governmental perspective, the government of Persia set up a Jew who was in charge of running the Jewish community. That Jew was descendant from the house of David all the way through from the beginning to the end, and was a pretender to the throne. If the Jews were ever to go back and rebuild the Beis HaMikdash during this time period, which I remind you, the Beis that we think about, like, that's like a crazy thought, where the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed in the year 70. So right after that, the person put in place, 100, 200, there were only a couple hundred years after the destruction, the first Beis HaMikdash was only destroyed for 70 years until it was rebuilt. So So it was not unthinkable, as the Jews were settling into Babylon and the Babylonian community, they're going to go back and rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. The person in charge, the exilarch, was descended from the house of David, and he would have been the king had the Jews returned. Now the Babylonian or Persian, I should really say to be more accurate, they set up a very funny system of government. Temporal items, taxes, running the laws, things like that were in the charge of the exilarch. That's who they appointed to run it. And spiritual matters were supposed to be run by the two heads of the yeshiva, the two gaonim, the head of Surah and the head of Pumbedisa. And that's sort of how the system worked. You should just know, by the way, the exilarch actually had so much power, he had the ability to execute anyone who violated Jewish law. He had the law, he had the power by the Persian government to set up courts, and in the courts that he set up, he could execute. Let me just repeat that. This is like what every rabbi would imagine. Can you imagine? I could set up a law, and we have a real temporal power. Now, that created a little bit of a shift, because if you can imagine, so what you now have is an exilarch with extreme power, but the spiritual leadership of the Jewish people was in the hands of the two heads of the yeshiva. So it would be really simple if we could just cut life down the middle and say, okay, you take care of this and we'll take care of that. But as you all know, it doesn't quite go that way. Judaism believes there is nothing outside the realm of the spiritual. Even mundane laws are dictated by the laws of the Torah. So it's a really unclear division. And whereas the heads of the yeshiva were almost always scholars and always religious, pious Jews, the exilarch was not. That was a political position. And like all political positions, some of them were scholarly, very religious, pious Jews, and some of them were not. It's just a historical fact. So you have a tremendous tension between the Gaonim and the exilarch as far as running Jewish life. It's Rabbi Yisrael Salanter is reported to have said, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who lives much later, the founder of the Musar movement, this is probably an apocryphal story, but it's said over anyway, that when he got married, he said, he and his wife made up that in all matters of the home, the mundane matters, his wife was going to be in charge, and in all matters of the spirit, he was going to be in charge. That was their deal, and nobody argued about that. But they spent the next 50 years fighting over what were matters of the home and what was considered matters of the spirit. Because in Jewish life, that's not so simple. Yeah?
Who appointed the exilarch? So
it was the Persian government. When the Muslims come in, it was the Caliph of Baghdad appointed him. So this was the political system. Now this creates, all of that was background. I find all this stuff fascinating. So whether or not you do or you don't, I apologize for boring you. As we go through, this creates, now we're up to our story. In the 7th century, the Muslims come into existence, and they take over the world very, very quickly. So the area that they take over includes what we call today Iran, Iraq, Babylonia of that time, and they continue the process of establishing the exilarch. Like in the Caliph of Baghdad was in charge of appointing. Fine. Let me start. The following thing I'm about to say are facts. I'll tell you when we get into already the dispute as exactly what took place. In the year 760, there was an exilarch named Shlomo who dies. And he dies without any children. So when he dies, there's no obvious successor. And now you have a power vacuum between the Gaonim, who want to control the Jewish world, who want to make sure that matters of Jewish life are being run according to Torah life. So they want to appoint a Reish Galusa, an exilarch, who is going to work together with them. This Shlomo, who dies without any children, had two nephews. One of his nephews, the elder of the two, was a man by the name of Yoshiyahu, who seems to have been a very nice guy, but was not a very powerful personality. The younger son, the younger of his two nephews, was a man named Anan ben David, who by all accounts seems to have been a tremendously charismatic, powerful, scholarly person. That much, well, let me say one more thing. The Caliph of Baghdad appointed the younger son. Yeah? Did I get it wrong?
Yeah.
Oh. Anan is the older one. Yeah, that's where I said it backwards just now. Anan was the older one. And the caliph appointed the younger one to be the exilarch. That much seems to be agreed upon historical as fact. How that came about is already unclear. Whether or not the rabbis, the gaonim, the heads of the yeshiva, lobbied for him because it was critical to their ability to be able to run the Jewish community according to the laws of the Torah, that they lobbied for the caliph to do so, whether or not Anan didn't know politics well enough, he didn't buy off enough of the Muslim government, unclear. But he is left out, and he eventually goes off shortly thereafter and establishes his own exilarch. And establishes, well, if I can't be the exilarch of the Jews, I will establish my own community. I will share here a story which is said over in traditional Jewish sources as to how that took place. The Karaites themselves, on their websites and in scholarly journals, vehemently deny the following story as completely made up and having no historical truth. I have no opinion on the matter. It would be inappropriate to talk about the Karaites and not tell the story. But there are those, if you look into it, the Karaite, now, and you see, as soon as I tell the story, you'll see why it is this way, why the rabbinic tradition believes that the story took place, and why the Karaites themselves deny it vehemently. But the story is as it is, and it's worth sharing because it's part of our story. Anan ben David is left off the exilarch position. That much is historically, that's clear. He doesn't get it. He's not in charge. According to the story, he wanted to be in charge. So he did what every good Jew does when he wants to be in charge of a certain institution and he's not put in charge. Correct, exactly. He starts his own. Right? You can't be the rabbi of this shul, so you make your own shul. Everybody's heard of that. It's well known out there. So that's what he does. So he starts his own community. He gets a bunch of supporters because he is charismatic. He is a scholar. He's got a force of a personality. And he starts his own little group and they appoint him the exilarch. And everything is just fine except for one major problem. The original exilarch was appointed by the caliph of Baghdad. So if the caliph of Baghdad appoints an exilarch and you come along and say, that was a mistake, really it should be me, that was viewed as high treason. And because he was viewed now as being treason, in a form of violating treason against the caliph of Baghdad, he was arrested and thrown into jail, where he was going to be executed. The story goes, he was thrown into jail on a Sunday, he was going to be executed on that Friday following the Muslim prayers of that Friday. While he's in jail, he meets up with another disloyal Arab who had been thrown into jail by the name of Abdul, I think it's Haish, it'll come to me, who's the founder of one of the many sects of Islam. And he was in jail also for being a heretic against the caliph. And he says to Anan, you know, why don't you get out of this in the same way that I'm planning on getting out of this? I'm going to tell the caliph that I'm not a heretic against Islam. I actually am the head of my own religion. And therefore, I have every right to be the head of my own religion and practice as I want because I'm not going against Islamic tradition. I have my own thing. Why don't you say the same thing? And Anan does so, and he claims in front of the caliph that he's not violating the caliph's appointment of the exilarch. That appointee is indeed the exilarch of the Jews. He is indeed the exilarch of a different religion, not the religion of the Jews, his own thing. And the caliph says, okay, what's your religion? And so he pulls out, because he was a scholar, the old Sadducee tradition, which we learned about a couple of weeks ago, of denying the oral law, and he says, I'm the religion of... And I don't know if he named it right there on the spot of the Karaites or not, probably not. And that's how the story goes, how the Karaite religion was born. Karaites themselves, again, deny this vehemently. They say it's certainly not true. They have all sorts of questions on the story. Bottom line is, whether the story happened or not isn't really relevant to us. Anan ben David is the recognized start of the Karaite tradition in the 7th century. Whether or not it happened in this way or not really doesn't make that much of a difference to us as far as it goes. The Karaites themselves, if you look on their websites, will say, of course that story's not true, because we've been around since Moshe came down from Har Sinai. We didn't start in the 7th century. We've always been here. the truth is there have not been a group of people who denied the oral law throughout history. We have the group of the Sadducees. The Sadducees disappeared, if you remember, in the year 70 with the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And we don't really hear from them again until the year 600 when Hanan ben David comes along and really reintroduces many of those concepts. In any case, what we now have is Hanan ben David leading this group. He starts and creates a group that was very extreme. They're known as the Hananites, meaning they're actually a precursor to what we refer to as the Karaites. And it was a very, very literal reading of the Chumash. And a rejection of the oral law, as I have mentioned, and a very, very strict reading. He was very ascetic. And what he did was created a group that they believed they were the Aveli Tzion. They were the mourners of Jerusalem. Now, we mourn for Jerusalem. Every day we're supposed to mourn for Jerusalem. But in practice, our mourning really is 3 weeks, climaxed on Tisha B'Av. He created a religion which every day looked like Tisha B'Av. Every day was an intense mourning over the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Our Gemara talks about an idea of banning meat and wine post the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara says, since the temple's been destroyed, how can we eat meat? How can we drink wine? So the Gemara says, well, all right, if you want to say that, well, then we should ban fruits, because the Jews used to bring first fruits to the temple also. Now that there's no temple, we shouldn't be allowed to eat any fruits also. The Gemara says, you're right, we should ban first fruits. The Gemara says, well, if we're doing that, we really should ban water, because on Sukkot there would be a water libation. Since we can't do that anymore, then we should ban. The Gemara says, okay, fine, let's ban water. So we have no meat, we have no wine, we have no water, we have no fruit. And so we know that all the grains are brought in a mincha offering. We would offer barley flour and wheat flour. Let's ban all that. So the Gemara, the way that it's presented, the Gemara is questioning the person who suggested the meat and wine ban with all of these things. The Gemara says, you can't live. So the Gemara scales it back, and then we have the 3 weeks, you have the 9 days. There's limited forms in terms of the way that we mourn in practice over the destruction. It should be on a Jew's mind all the time. The very first words in the beginning of the Shulchan Aruch, our code of Jewish law, is that it is righteous for every Jew to be constantly aware of the destruction of the temple and mourning its loss. But in practice, we eat meat, and we drink wine, and we have flour, and barley flour, and wheat flour, and fruit. We do all those things. Hanan created a system in which he said, we can't do it. There's no meat, there's no wine. Now, in theory, he said, if you were able to eat meat, you could eat meat with your milk. In theory, just you can't eat meat because of destruction. Why? Why don't we eat meat and milk? Very good. The Torah says, three times the Torah says, Lo sevashel gedi b'chalei v'imo, do not cook a kid in its mother's milk. Three times the Torah says that. Our oral law tells us, why would you repeat the same thing three times? So the oral law teaches us, one time is to teach us you can't cook meat and milk together, which is what the verse actually says. A second time is to tell us you're not allowed to eat meat and milk together. And the third time is to teach you can't even derive any benefit, that even if it's been cooked together, you can't even sell it to somebody else, you can't get any benefit from it. But if you don't have an oral law, what's the only thing you have is you can't cook it together. Okay, you can't cook it together, but you can eat it together. So, surely you have to wait 6 hours between meanwhile. That's for sure. That's for sure. But they would even eat it. So he had a technical problem in which he held, you shouldn't be eating meat post the destruction. But there would be no problem of eating meat and milk together. The only problem is cooking it. And even in cooking it, it's only cooking a kid, a goat, in its mother's milk. Where would you get from there, you know, buying, getting milk from this cow and not cooking that meat? A totally separate thing. That's an example of where the oral law that we have explains. The written law tells you don't cook a kid in its mother's milk, and we have a tradition that says this is what that means. Well, if you don't buy into that tradition, well then all you have is don't cook a kid in its mother's milk. Now, he had all sorts of other practices. For example, on Shabbos it says, Lo siva'aru esh, you may not kindle a fire. So you can't kindle a fire on Shabbos. We understand that based on our tradition from the oral law to mean you may not kindle a fire, but if a fire existed before Shabbos started, totally fine. Not only is it totally fine, but that's what we do on purpose. We light Shabbos candles right before Shabbos so that we may have light, so that we may enjoy Shabbos, so that Shabbos should be pleasurable. That's exactly why we light candles. Hanan understood. The Torah says you may not kindle fire on Shabbos, and therefore they did just the opposite. Whereas we on Friday night run around turning on all the lights, He would have everybody running around their houses on Shabbos, blowing out all the candles. Certainly there was no hot food by definition on Shabbos, and the extremists says, lo teitze ish mim mekomo, a man may not go out of his place on Shabbos. Which we understand to mean, outside of the tchum, the 2,000 amos from the end of your city, you can't go beyond that. But if you read that literally, it would say, a man may not go out of his place on Shabbos. So guess what they did? They sat home. So in the dark, no hot food, was their Shabbos. Now, that kind of, let me go first. So the sermon was no Hanukkah, no Purim. Because Hanukkah and Purim, even though both of those stories have happened already, we're already in the year 600. But they're all rabbinic. Both of those stories, they are the classic mitzvahs derabbanan, rabbinic mitzvahs which we have. So they certainly didn't celebrate either of those. But not only do they not celebrate any of those, the Torah also says, Ani Hashem Rofa'echa. Hashem says in a verse, I am God, your healer. So the Karaites say, great, who's your healer? God. What about that doctor over there? Forbidden. So there was no going to doctors, there were none of the Hanukkah, it was a pretty miserable experience. It was not a pleasant lifestyle. Which means that really, it just should have died out. It was a group that got started, they were extremists, there was no, very little love, it wasn't warm, it was rough. And it would have and should have died out, but it doesn't. It catches on. And the questions I will now discuss for a few minutes, why? What was going on that allowed for this to catch on like this? So let's talk about some of the factors. Three major factors that are discussed amongst, if you looked into various sources regarding this period of time, which are important for us to recognize as this is going to begin to catch on and spread. Number one, Muslims have taken over the world, a good part of it. In the early 7th century, Muhammad creates this new religion. Within 200 years, it's going to spread throughout the world, threaten all of Christianity, which at that point, the Roman Empire had spread Christianity almost everywhere. This is going to be the big threat, and it had taken over half the world. But Muslims and the Muslim religion is very sectarian. It's very divided amongst different groups. It's not a unified whole, as much as we might like to think of it. Those who know it's completely not that way. And it began in its very beginning. Many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the Sunnis and the Shiites. And you know when that started? That's the very first generation. After Muhammad dies, there was a dispute as to who his successor should be. Should it be a fellow named Ali, which was his nephew who married his own daughter? Or should it be his father-in-law, who was his first convert? Right away, he dies. Who's the next in charge? So those who felt it was Ali became one group, and those who thought it was supposed to be his father-in-law, was the other group. One became what we know as the Sunnis, one became known as what we know as the Shiites. This is back in the 600s. Those who think that the Sunni-Shiite conflict has any resolution around the bend does not understand when it started. And it's just as unlikely as understanding that some Western mind is going to come into the Middle East today and work out the Israeli situation. You have to understand where things are coming from. So that Shiite-Sunni battle is a long-standing battle, and it goes back to the heart of the religion as to who was supposed to take it over and where is it supposed to go. But those aren't the other. The Hashemites, there are tons of them. So when the Muslims come over and they sweep over the world in this time period, 6th century, 7th century, 8th century, what they bring with them is an idea that if you don't like the way the religion is being practiced, start your own. Now, I don't mean to blame our assumption that we do the same thing on the Muslims. But we're affected by our environment. We're impacted by that. The Jews in this time of Babylonia are now, for the first time in just for only 100 years, are taken over by a culture that thinks that way. That just within a religion, you break off and start a new type of a religion. And when you're around that, it impacts the way that you think. We experience in this community, maybe you don't experience the way I do. I have, when younger folks move into town, and they come from other places, like Flatbush, Brooklyn, Chicago, L.A., so they come into town, and there are a very limited number of shuls in the area. And so they come in when there's like whatever unrest there is, and they'll come in very honestly. They're like, "So why don't we just start another shul?" Now, to the local Atlantan, it's like, "How can you say that? Meanwhile, they're coming from a community where that's what you do. Like every 6 months, a group of 20 Jews decides that they don't like whatever it is that they are, and so they go into a basement and they start another shul. And nobody says boo. It's just how it goes. That's how it is in some of those communities. So when you bring that in, and they're not being malicious, they're just saying, like, I don't understand. If we have 30 people, 40 people here, that's enough for two shuls. Why don't we just start something already? They're like, they think we're like, they're done. But meanwhile, the culture here is like, wait a minute, we don't do that. Well, what was introduced into the Jewish life at this point was, that's normal. That's what the Muslim dominant culture, the Jews with the minority culture, they bring in a sense of, that's what you do. We are impacted by our surroundings. You can't deny that. American Jews think differently than French Jews, think differently than Israeli Jews. We're products of our environment. And that's one major thing to recognize. This is before Ashkenazim and Sephardim. We're not there yet in history. This is where we are. The Jews have left Israel, they're in Babylonia, this is the bulk of the Jewish community, there's small pockets elsewhere, but this is where things are, and it gets overrun by the Muslims in the 7th century, and now there's this new element in there. That's number one. Number two, which is very relevant for us, is that people generally did not necessarily like the Gaonim. Meaning they didn't like the rabbis, because the rabbis are running everything. And we're introducing again, as I stressed earlier, the oral law has now been codified. It's now in a book form for the first time, and they're administering it. And they're running the courts. And if you're running the court system, anytime two people come into court, almost always, how many losers are going to walk out of court? Two, that's right, almost always. That's the way it goes, yeah. Because no one's going to be happy. If they ended up in court, very rarely do they both walk out saying, that was really good for me. Sometimes one does, but never both. And often both work out unhappy. So after all these years of the Gaonim running the system, there were those who weren't happy with the rabbinic leadership, as often happens. And now what you have is this mix of a new dominant culture that comes in and says, you don't like the leadership? Start something else. Together with a system that's been there for hundreds of years, which over the fact that it's been there for hundreds of years takes place. Rabbi Wein likes to point out a very important human reality in religious circles, that God bears the brunt of human error. Meaning, if I am a rabbi and I represent God and I mess up. I'm also human. I might represent God. I might be a rabbi, but I'm a human. If I mess up and hurt you, what happens is God bears the brunt of that. The person who I hurt says, well, this isn't a religion that I want anything to be part of. So what have they done? So they've thrown out their relationship with God because a Jew who represents him indeed hurt him. And he did. The Jew really did hurt him. The Jew really misrepresented God. And God bears the brunt of that. He tells the story of Rabbi Wein himself. I always love his anecdotes. He was in Israel once and he had a meeting with the rabbinic office of that particular city. So the rabbinic office in Eretz Yisrael, they're in charge of marriages and divorces and all sorts of rabbinic life cycle, also spiritual, religious life cycle events. So Rabbi Wein had a meeting with him at 12. Because in Israel, as you know, also offices like close for lunch. And like when they close, they shut the door, lock it, close up shop. So the Rav, who had this meeting with Rabbi Wein, set up a meeting with him at 12. They were going to close for lunch, and he was going to have his meeting. So Rabbi Wein got there at 11:45, and as he's getting 11:45, the guy in charge of the office, as Rabbi Wein likes to point out, in Israel, when they close at 12, that means at 12 they're already home. They've closed up at 11:45 so that they can get home at 12 for their hour break. So he's locking up the door at 11:45. And as everyone's walking in, and this guy's locking up the office, the chayal comes running in, panting, sweating, literally running in. And he says, as out of breath, he's getting married in 2 weeks. He's stationed somewhere up north. This is the only day that he has to take care of his stuff. His officer let him out just today. He got up at 4 o'clock in the morning to catch a bus from the north to get here to the city to get his marriage license. And he needs to get back on the next bus at 1. I need my marriage list so I can get married in 2 weeks. So the guy running the office says, sorry, we're closed. So the chayal goes to the store. He says, no. I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning. This is the only time I came over here. I'm a little more forceful. And I need this done. And the guy says, yeah, I don't care. Office closed. So Rabbi Wein says, as the American, like watching this scene, he can't help himself. So he steps in and he says, well, what's the big deal? Just fill out the mayors. So then he gets yelled at, like, who are you, American, coming over here telling us what to do? Meanwhile, this whole commotion, the Rav comes out of his office, sees what's going on, sends the head of the office home, says, close up, you go home. And then he took care of the guy, filled out the paperwork, and sent the chayal back to his base. When Rabbi Wein gets into his office, is down for his meeting, so the Rav said, with such pain in his voice, he said, that chayal is now lost forever. We will never be able to talk to him about Shabbos or Kashrus. It's over. You lost him. And it's true, and it's irrelevant. Because he met up with one guy who manages an office, who's having a bad day, who just wants to close up shop, whatever. What does it have to do with the truth of Shabbos? It has nothing to do with the truth of Shabbos. But we all know that the Rav is right. It's lost. That chayal will never be able to, like, Shabbos, not for me. This is not for me. So that happens. In the classic way that it's raised, never confuse Judaism with the Jews. Right? The Jews are Jews. Jews are people. Jews are people too, We are. We make mistakes. Judaism is perfect. The Jews? A little bit less so. But we confuse the two. And we have a bad experience with somebody who represents Judaism, and we interpret that to be Judaism. That's not fair, but it's true. It's what happens. So you have a system here in Babylonia where the Gaonim are running the show. The Gaonim are a two-headed system, so to speak, which means there's always going to be some politicking between the two of them. There are two major yeshivas, a yeshiva in Sura, a yeshiva in Pumbedisa. Things are probably not always perfectly smooth. You have the dynamic between the yeshivas and the Reish Galusa, the Exilarch. You have a system that's gone on. So you have people who probably felt that it wasn't the greatest of systems in a culture together with this new idea of, well, just start your own, and the two mix. There's a third factor. By the way, the Karaites are going to catch on much stronger in Israel and Egypt than they do in Babylonia for this, because they're getting away from the seat of rabbinic power, which is in Babylonia. So the farther away from that you go, the stronger you have the Karaites really taking hold. But anyway, the third factor was that there was a rabbinic policy towards all sorts of schisms and difficulty, and that is, just ignore it. Let it, it'll disappear, it'll go away. And this has been something which, as we go through all of these different controversies throughout Jewish history, I don't know that we're going to come to a conclusion as to what's the right way. Should you ignore it, or should you tackle it head on? We'll see. Each controversy are going to have its personalities who do so. We're going to see that tonight already. Some personalities who tackle it. Some personalities who hope it just disappears. If I put my head in the sand long enough, it will just dissipate. Different ways of dealing with it. At the time, the way that the rabbis dealt with it was just, all right, there's this group that's here, let's just ignore it. So, sometimes it works, sometimes doesn't work. When the Reform began with their Bible criticism in the 19th century, before the rabbinic world woke up to it, to respond to it, most of that would happen. So some secular Jew is coming up with a course to do Bible criticism. So what was the response of the rabbis? Whatever, what does it do with me? I have to deal with that. But meanwhile, it went on for long enough, before you knew it, you turned around and there was a chair in the University of Bible Criticism. Well, now it's too late to deal with it, because it's here. It's already there. It's now there are those who have a vested interest in maintaining it because there's a chair. Somebody funded a chair to have this coursework, and now you got to deal with it. That's what happens if you ignore it. So is that always the right response? That is it. But that's how they dealt with it. That's how they dealt with it back then. We'll see. There are other approaches. The Chassam Sofer, when we're going to deal with the Reform movement later on, he tackled it head on. He fought them, as we'll see, was Rav Sadia Gaon's approach to. We'll get to in a few minutes here also. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, when he discussed what was going on with the Reform movement, said, I wouldn't have banned them. I would have created a base medrash in every single community and brought them into study. Very different approach, which we'll see will manifest itself throughout history. But in any case, we have these three factors come together. So you have this beginning of Anan ben David. He begins this denial of the oral law. We'll get to some more details in a second about that. And the movement begins to take on life when you put all these factors together. The leadership, about 100 years after Anan ben David, when it should have just fizzled out and died, realized how severe he had made it, and how impossible it was to maintain, how unattractive it was, and so they adapted it. And they created the system, which is what more exists now, of interpretations. It didn't have to be literal readings. There could be interpretations of it. And that the Talmud is an interpretation of the written law. It's just not the interpretation. So that's fine. We could take that into account. We could think about it. And you know what? If we like part of it and not the other part, we'll take this, but not the other. And they began to almost create their own Talmud of interpretation, because this made more sense. So that it became much softer, because the practices were not as severe, and now you had the ability to say, here's the Chumash, and now we have the ability to interpret it as we would like. We're no longer bound to the rabbinic tradition as codified in the Talmud of, this is what it means. Classic example, what do we take on Sukkot together with our lulav? An esrog. How many times does the word esrog appear in the Chumash? Zero. Zero. What does the Torah say? Pre Eitz Hadar. A beautiful fruit of the tree. Well, what's a Pre Eitz Hadar? So we have a tradition that every single Torah observant community from the time that Moshe came down from Har Sinai has taken an Esrog. How is it possible that every single Jewish community has simultaneously understood the phrase Pre Eitz Hadar to mean an Esrog? Because we have a tradition. That's part of what it means to have an oral law that comes together with a written law. Pre Eitz Hadar means take an Esrog. Well, if you don't have to abide by that, what can you take on Sukkot? You're going to take something because the Torah says it. What do you take? I don't know. You want to take a rose? You want to take, if that's maybe not even a fruit, an apple, an orange, whatever you want. Because the Torah just says, take a beautiful fruit, and you're no longer bound. An esrog is an interpretation, but it doesn't have to be the interpretation. This movement spread, this ability to say, I believe in Torah, and I'm actually a purer belief in Torah than those rabbinic Jews over there. I have it right, because I'm only... They're adding all of these rabbinic interpretations. That caught on. That spread. The ability to say, I can read as I like, and not only can I, but that I'm supposed to, so that when I observe as I do, I'm doing the pure form. I want to read you a quote. I'm skipping down in the notes, down to the box. This came from a wonderful paper I came across as I was preparing for this by a fellow by the name of, where I have it there, I'm looking at the wrong sheet. Yeah, Simon, it was not written in English, it was translated from whatever language he wrote it in. 150 page, really exposition on the doctrines and history of the Karaites. And I read the first 20 or so pages, which he's talking about the introduction of some of their thoughts. Two quotes from this work. Number one, he's describing the Karaite tradition as to their belief system. Everyone must interpret the precepts according to his intelligence and comprehension. Do not accept blindly the opinions of others. He who confines himself to performing the rites without understanding them is scarcely different, should be different from a donkey that pulls a load. Yehuda Hadassi, the great Karaite author from the Byzantine period of the 13th century, maintained one is not obligated to follow a precept if he does not understand it. Now I want to talk here about what they've done. Judaism is a very fascinating, it's a dynamic, it's a live religion. And what we deal with every day is a balance. It's a magnificent, beautiful balance that says, this is the law, do it, now understand it. Nase v'nishma. So that, I don't understand tefillin. I don't care. Wake up and put them on. And now after you put them on, come, let's learn. Ask every question you got. Let's study the text. Let's study the Mishnah. Let's study the Gemara. Ask, 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 ask. And tomorrow when you say, I don't get it yet, too bad. Put them on. Back to the base medrash we go. So that these are the rituals. These are the mitzvahs. I understand them, I don't understand them. Some of them I'm supposed to understand, some of them I don't understand. Does it matter in practice whether I understand or not? Absolutely not. But then we say, Nishma. Go learn. Go ask. Where else, other than in a Beis Medrash, do you find people who are so dedicated to their religion, questioning with such passion if it makes sense or not? That's a Beis Medrash. That's the study of the Talmud. Is it like this? Is it like that? Why? How? When? But the ritual, the rite, the doing it, that's not up for grabs. We don't say, when I understand Shabbos, I'll keep Shabbos. When I understand kashrus, I'll keep it. I keep kosher. I keep Shabbos. And then we'll study and ask as much as we want. Rabbi David Foreman, I'm sure I've quoted this before. Rabbi David Foreman tells over, he was here a couple years ago, if you remember. He was in Baltimore at the time. He was invited to speak on a radio station, a non-Jewish, a Christian radio station. He asked him to deliver one of his lectures on the Ten Commandments. He has a whole approach on the Ten Commandments. Why these ten, five, whatever it was. So the way that, if you remember anything from Rabbi David Foreman, the way that he delivers his lectures, as many do, is you start off by asking a whole bunch of questions. Because in Judaism, because as an educator knows, the only real way to impart information is to create a void in the listener who says, yeah, what's the answer to that question? If I'm not bothered by the question, then the information you have for me is irrelevant to me. I don't care about the information. If you tell me that, what is the answer to that question? I always wanted to know that. I'll listen to you because I'm curious. So a good class, you'll always notice, will start with a series of questions on the text or whatever we're talking about. It's literally to draw you in to say, you need this information. You're missing something and I have it. You want to know what it is? I'll tell it to you. That's education in a nutshell. So Rabbi Foreman begins his class and he asks 1,000 questions on the Ten Commandments. Why these five? Why this order? Why were the five between man and between God first? Why not second? A ton of questions on them. And then as radio programs, he ran out of time. He didn't answer most of the questions. So the host then opens up the station to questions. So the question is, someone calls up and starts yelling at me, blasphemer, heretic, how can we have this? How dare you ask questions on God's Word? So Rabbi Foreman used to point out, I've heard this from him, that question is the difference between Judaism and many other religions and sects out there. Of course you ask questions. If you start with, this is God's Word, then you can ask anything you want. This is the Word. This is what I do. This is what I keep. Now, why this one, not that one? I'm not afraid of the question. There's an answer to all the questions. It's divine. I'm not bothered by the question. Ask away. But I do it whether or not I understand it, because it's God's Word also. And then I ask. And then I question. And the more I ask, and the more I question, the more I understand. This concept is a tweak of that, but it's a significant tweak. And it's a tweak that's so significant because we all have questions. We have questions. And we need to ask the questions, which we do. The Karaites believed, again, you must interpret it according to your intelligence and comprehension. And that's where we differ that first line. I need to ask, I need to understand, but I can't necessarily interpret according to my understanding. Maybe my understanding is flawed. Who says that I have the divine understanding of what was intended? If the oral law tells me what was intended, that's what was intended. The fact that I might want to interpret it differently, that's my interpretation, that's not the interpretation. But the Karaites taught, you must interpret it according to your intelligence and comprehension, and you're not allowed to accept blindly the opinions of others. You can't. You're a donkey leading a cart if you accept blindly, and you're not allowed to do the things that you don't understand. Reading to the next paragraph. A basic viewpoint is that the individual alone is responsible for himself before his God. You're the individual, you're responsible. Social conformism is thus withdrawn from the individual. The fact that your community does it this way, yeah, but I see it differently. We have a concept in Pirkei Avos, al tifrosh min hatzibur, don't separate yourself from the tzibur. The Jewish people survive because we're a community. We're a tzibur together. Within that tzibur, everybody's an individual. But we're within the context of a tzibur. Everyone from the community, they're free. Because what makes us a tzibur is we have this system. There's a basic tenet of belief, understanding of interpretation. Well, if you don't have that, then every individual is responsible for himself. There's no intermediary between himself and God. Every individual has priestly characteristics. Because the Torah says, you are to me a nation of priests. That's true. That's what the Torah says. Rashi says, what does it mean, a nation of priests? You're a nation of sarim, of officers. You are my priestly nation amongst the nations of the world to bring my word out to them. Not literally priests, because only the children of Aaron are priests. But you will serve the world as my priest. So they read it as, you're all priests, you do whatever. You serve yourself. You don't need anyone. Remember, there is no temple anymore. You don't need anyone. You don't need any rabbi. You don't need any interpretation. You don't need the oral law to tell you what to do. You can do that all yourself. Let me go back a little bit. The letter G, the three parts to the oral law. I've been talking about oral law, oral law, oral law. What is the oral law? We've discussed this in previous years. I'll do a very brief synopsis of what we've discussed in the past. The Rambam, Maimonides, lists three components to the oral law. Number one are what we call traditions. Traditions is not necessarily his word. What we mean to say is, literally, we have a tradition as to what a word in the Torah means. I've mentioned a number of them tonight. Pre-Eitz Adar. We have a tradition that means an esrog. We have a tradition of shechita, how to perform the ritual slaughter. When the Torah says, by a mezuzah, write these words on your mezuzah. What words? What words? It charges us, write these words. So we have a tradition. That means this. We have a series of traditions like that. There's a second section called the exegesis, in which the sages of the Talmud, for anyone who's learned Talmud before, sees in a word, they connect words, they connect concepts. This word is to be darshan, to be expounded on, to mean this, in which we derive many of the laws. For example, I mentioned one, Lo Sevashil Gadi Bachalev Imo, do not cook a kid in its mother's milk three times. The sages derive what that means is forbidden to cook, to get hana, to get pleasure, or to eat. All biblically forbidden. What do you mean, Billy? The Torah only says don't cook. We have the sages deriving from the way the Torah gives us the rules of how to read in between the lines. That means don't cook three times. What it means is don't cook, don't eat, don't benefit. So it's biblically forbidden, even though it was the sages who expounded upon it. That's the bulk of the Talmud, similar type of statements. And there's a third section of the oral law, which is indeed rabbinic in nature. There are rabbinic law, Hanukkah, Purim, for example. Many of the fences that the sages have created for us, those are all rabbinic. The Torah gives the rabbis the authority, do not veer from your left or from your right, from that which they say. But the actual decrees are indeed rabbinic, and in fact, no rabbinic Jew would ever argue against the Karaites on that point. The rabbis indeed made that up. That part of the oral law, the rabbis created the law of Hanukkah. They did. No one denies that. They created the laws of Muktzah. Who says I can't pick up a pen on Shabbos? Well, the rabbis did, because they didn't want you to write with it. And many, many, many other rabbinic laws. So encompassed within the oral law are real traditions from Sinai, is the bulk, plus some actual rabbinic law. Yeah?
At what point did the rabbinic laws take on the same force as biblical law?
So they have that. So that's derived from the Torah itself, that the rabbis have the authority to make those laws. So we have already rabbinic decrees from Moshe himself. We have reading the Kriyas Torah, the concept of reading from the Torah every week on Shabbos is already a rabbinic law, already from the times of Moshe. And we have throughout history certain rabbinic laws. Those are actual rabbinic law. The Gemara itself says that rabbinic law is more dear, chaviv in Yisrael, is more precious to the Jewish people than biblical law. For the reason of, when you protect something, when you show that I really value this so much that I accept the fence, it's because I value what it's protecting. It means something to me. When you put that little yellow line down on a subway station, no, I value my life. And I value the life of those around me. So yeah, I don't go near that. I could go to the edge, but it's not worth it. So when the sages put all these fences up and the Jewish people accept them upon themselves, they're saying what they're protecting is so important that we abide by the rabbinic law in order to protect that which is the biblical law, which is being protected. But all of that's encompassed within the oral law, which the Karaites did away with all of it. In other words, they said, you rabbis made stuff up. And the rabbi said, that's right, we did. We didn't make up Hanukkah, we made up Purim, and we made up all of these rabbinic decrees as fences. But they threw out everything. They said, so if you made that up, you can't tell us what to do as far as that goes. And the whole oral law gets thrown out with that as well. Okay. Now, some of their questions that they asked, I'll do this quickly. They asked a series of questions to say, it can't be that the oral law really is true. Because number one, they said, if God gave Moshe an oral law and he intended to keep it oral, don't you think God would have been able to see into the future to know there'd be a time where it had to be written down? So why would he give an oral law if it couldn't be maintained as oral? That's one of the philosophical questions that they ask. And who gave you the right to write it down? If it was indeed supposed to be oral and it was going to be forgotten, maybe that's what God intended. Who are you to say it was supposed to be oral, but now that it's going to be forgotten, we're going to write it down? And why does it never say in the Mishnah or in the Gemara, like it does in the Chumash, so said God to Moshe? It always says, Rabbi Akiva said, Rabbi Meir said. It's saying as if it came from the rabbis, not from God. And why is there so much dispute? If this is really divine, we shouldn't have all of this argument. And a series of other questions. They have a whole series of things. It can't obviously be. Now, there are many, many long refutations of each and every one of those points. Reb Sadia Gaon, the last thing I'm going to talk about in letter H, are the different types of responses. Reb Sadia Gaon went on the offensive. Reb Sadia Gaon lived from the year 892 to 942. So he's living already again now 200 years after Anan ben David has begun, after the second tier of Karaites have really adopted the religion and made it more palatable, made it fitting for somebody who wanted to say, I believe in Torah. And that's what was so palatable about the Karaites was, I am a Jew. I believe in the Torah. I believe it is divine. It's just that the rabbis are making stuff up that I don't have to listen to. So it became a very palatable. He went on the offensive and he wrote polemics. He wrote long books. He wrote essays. He would go around and he would lecture and he would pound them. And he did quite a job of really knocking down the bulk of Karaite communities. He made a ton of enemies amongst the Karaite community because of what he did. But he took that approach. And he wrote long polemics arguing point by point everything that he said. It's just worth noting, we've spoken about this before, what was the greatest value of an oral law? We've spoken about this before. The great value of the oral law is that you need to have a teacher. You have to have a Rebbe. Because who's going to teach it to you if it's an oral law? Once there's a Rebbe, there's a face-to-face dialogue. You're no longer reading something without passion. You're no longer reading something without tone, without nuance. There has to be a communication between a Rebbe and a Talmud, a teacher and his student. And the oral law maintained that. It kept the tradition alive in a way that would be totally different than the written law. And even when it was written down, anyone who studied the Talmud knows, it's still an oral law. You have to have somebody to teach. You cannot pick it up and just read a book in English and think you're going to get it. It's as if we created a second set of cliff notes. Like the Torah itself is the cliff notes for the lecture. And then the oral law, which was written down, is just a series of cliff notes to that, in which you have the oral law. And then look at the number of books that have been written on the oral law itself, on the Talmud, to expound, to explain. And it's a living, dynamic system in which you still have those elements of it being an oral law are completely maintained even after it's been written down. And those are just some of the additional benefits of why that was done. We've discussed several times as well the change when we went from prophecy to the sage. When the Jews come back and they lose prophecy, the Torah is no longer transmitted through the prophets, but it's transmitted through the sages. And that's where we now have this statement of Rabbi Akiva says, Rabbi Meir says, beforehand it was just through a prophetic form of Torah and the change. We've spoken about this in the past and I don't want to get into it again much now. But that is one of the major issues that exists. Rabbi Wein points out what the Karaites created looked very similar to the Muslim religion and was really a conduit for people to actually leave. That's really what happened. Is the Jews, many of the Jews who became Karaites were only a generation away from then just becoming Muslim in their Muslim surroundings. They were much more similar to the Muslims in the way that they did. So if you look at some of the websites and you'll see the way the Jews practice now, one of the websites that describe, they're Jews who look like Muslims. In the way that they pray on carpeted floor, they bow down. There are a lot of Muslim practices which they adopted and they kept because of the way that they mingled amongst themselves. One last thing that I want to share with you tonight is the Rambam. The Rambam was one of the last pitched battle against the Karaites, because the Karaites became very strong in Egypt. Reb Sadia Gaon in the Babylonian area, by the time he dies in 942, by the year 1000, they're pretty much finished there. He really did a number on them and on those against them. But in Egypt, they were still a very, very strong community. When the Rambam gets there, he finds that nearly two-thirds of the Jews in Egypt were identified with Karaites. And so here he comes in, the champion of Torah Rabbinic Judaism, and he's got a major community that is not, shall we say, rabbinic in nature. Now, just to describe what it was like, and the intermingling of the two communities in the Cairo Geniza, in which they discovered all sorts of old documents, they found seven ksuvas, seven marriage contracts, which were marriage contracts between rabbinic Jews who were marrying Karaite Jews. So you have to understand the social dynamic that's taking place. One of the major things that I didn't get into over here, one of the major, major battles between the Karaites and the rabbinic Jews was the calendar. Because the Torah is very clear on a concept called Rosh Chodesh, which means that the first of the month is based on when you see the new moon. But the Torah also says, Shamor es Chodesh Ha'aviv. You have to guard the springtime when it comes to Pesach to make sure that Pesach always falls in the spring. Well, that's not really what that means. That's the way the sages understood. When the Torah says, Shamor es Chodesh Ha'aviv, it means the Torah tells you, make sure that Pesach always falls in the springtime. But it's not a literal translation. So the Karaites didn't believe in that. They believed, when is Rosh Chodesh? The new moon. So the rabbinic tradition, if you ever pay attention when we announce the new moon every month, you ever pay attention, it says the new moon will be seen in Jerusalem on Sunday morning, 2 minutes after 15 Chalakim. And when is Rosh Chodesh? You know, Tuesday. So they, wait a minute, didn't you just announce that the new moon is going to be seen on Sunday morning? Why is Rosh Chodesh on Tuesday? So the reason for that is because in the tremendously complex rabbinic calendar, in order to allow for all the things that have to go in, Rosh Chodesh is not always on the actual new sighting of the new moon. And it's always been that way since the time that Moshe came down from Har Sinai, because that's the way the Torah was given. But if you disregard half of the Torah, i.e. the oral part, what you're left with is when there's a new moon. Which means that almost every single yontif that the Karaites have, they celebrated Pesach and Sukkot and Shavuot because it says so in the Torah, it, almost every single year it would be 1 to 2 days off from when the rest of the Jewish world would celebrate it. Well, that's a real tricky situation if you're having a community that's sort of intermingled. The New York Times article opens with the Rosh Hashanah celebrations of the Karaite community, how it describes the celebrations, and then the author writes, the only problem is they're 2 days too late. The rest of the land in Israel, meaning the other 8 million people there, celebrated Rosh Hashanah 2 days earlier. And this little community celebrating Rosh Hashanah 2 days after we did. So they found in the Geniza in Cairo marriage contracts. In Cairo between these different things. And these were the things that were written into the contracts. I have them in big letter, capital letter H. Number one, the husband, the rabbinite's husband, the man who was from the rabbinic tradition, promises not to bring certain parts of an animal into the home, because Karaite law, which had a different tradition of what was considered kosher and not kosher, there are certain parts of the animal that Jews, we would eat, that they did not eat. So in the marriage contract, the husband promises not to bring certain animals in. He promises not to engage in any marital relations on Shabbos or holidays, because in Karaite tradition, it was absolutely forbidden. In Karaite tradition, peru urvu, be fruitful and multiply, was a blessing, not a commandment. As a blessing, you should be fruitful and multiply, and therefore relations were only permitted to be fruitful and to multiply. It was forbidden on holy days like Shabbos and Yontif. It was forbidden if a woman was already pregnant. It was forbidden if she was nursing. It was a different system. And in the marriage contracts, when they would intermarry, so to speak, in the contract would be, you, the husband, agree not to engage in any relations on days when your Karaite wife holds that it's forbidden to have relations. The husband would also have to agree not to demand of his wife to light Shabbos candles. Because in the Karaite community, you're blowing out the candles when Shabbos starts, not lighting them. And they each had to agree to observe each other's holidays. So you think Pesach is bad as we have it. Imagine if you had to observe Pesach twice. But that, they found seven different marriage contracts. They found that in each contract they had, these were the things. The Rambam shows up and he sees a mess. This is a disaster. What? This is not going to work as far as the community goes. The Rambam had a fascinating approach, which I want to share with you how we dealt with this. Now, this is going to be historical for us as far as, here you have a real problem. You have a group of Jews saying, we're Jewish, We have the right tradition, and it's wrong. It is not on the branch of Judaism, because they're ignoring, let's call it half, of what the Torah really says. So everything is misinterpretations. You're putting it in the verse, but that's not what the verse means. It's not the tradition that we have. So the Rambam did a couple of things. Number one, he said, the marriages to a Karaite Jew might be valid, but their gittin, when they divorce, are certainly not valid. Because almost all of the traditions that we have as part of the get come from the oral law. Exactly, the verse in the Torah says almost nothing. It says a man wants to divorce his wife, he sends her away. He writes her a bill of divorce. Well, what does it say in it? The Torah doesn't say anything. So if you learn Maseches Gittin, it's very clear what needs to be done and what can't be done. Well, the Karaites clearly didn't do that, which means the Rambam said all their divorces are invalid. Well, if a divorce is invalid and a woman marries again, problem, because she's really married to the first husband, which means that the children she has from the second marriage are mamzerim, you're not allowed to marry them. So the Rambam came into Egypt and he said, you're not permitted to marry any Karaite woman or any Karaite child because there's a valid concern that they're all mamzerim. And that put an end to the intermarriage, and it put an end to that intermingling. And then he went about and he did the following thing, fascinating. He said as follows, when it comes to religious things, they're absolutely not accepted. You may not accept a Karaite in a minyan. He does not count as one of the 10. He does not count as one of the 3 for a zimun, because they don't believe in the rabbinic concept that says you need a minyan. Where does that concept come from? The Torah doesn't say you need a minyan to daven. The Torah doesn't say you need a minyan for anything. The concept of a minyan is our tradition that we have in the oral law, which is derived from verses in the Torah. The 10 spies are called an Eda. They're called a group. And we learn from there, from other places, there's a concept of 10. You need a quorum for Dvarim Shebekdusha to say Kaddish Kedusha. Karaites didn't hold of any of that. So Rambam says, we can't count them if they don't believe. Like, you count, but you deny everything that we're doing. So Rambam says they didn't count. He would not accept them for the 3. But, as opposed to Reb Stajigon, who went around and he blasted them and he had polemics and he discussed and he attacked, the Rambam never did that. He never excommunicated. He did not have any polemics in which he went around and he talked. And he said, he demanded, and I didn't quote the whole thing in his words, they be treated with respect and dignity as any human being, particularly a Jew, to act justly, peacefully, truthfully, and humbly with them. You're allowed to perform a bris on their children on Shabbos. These are the questions that are asked. The Karaite Jew has a baby on Shabbos, and he asks the Moel to do it. Are you allowed to do it? Performing a bris on Shabbos is not allowed. The only reason why you're allowed to do something like that is because it's a mitzvah. Am I allowed to perform a bris milah on a Karaite Jew on Shabbos? Says the Rambam, yes, you're allowed to do that. You're allowed to bury their dead. You're allowed to mourn for their dead. You're allowed to do all those things. As a human being goes, you treat them with the utmost of respect. Except when it comes to religious life, you can't count them in a minyan. So he balanced, as far as the religion goes, they're out. They are not part of our religion. They are. If you don't accept the oral law, you're not. That's not Torah Judaism. You're making up Torah Judaism. So when it came to religious life, he said no. When it came to interpersonal relationships, he was adamant that he was not going to go on an offensive. And instead, he became their Rav. He became the Rav of Egyptian Jewry. And family by family, taught and created relationships. By the time he's done in Egypt, by the time of his death, he's almost completely eradicated the Karaite religion without excommunicating, without frontal attacks, by splitting in a very fine line, I can't accept you for my minion, but I'd love to have coffee with you, kind of thing. And he writes, whereas you have to accept them for everything, he says, but you're not allowed to visit them on their holidays. When they're observing Pesach, you can't go over and pay them a call to wish them a good yontif, because it's not Pesach. And it has to be clear to you that it's not Pesach right now. Pesach is on this day. This is when the oral law tells us when the yontif is. That's yontif. So if they're celebrating Pesach 2 days later, you can't go and visit them on Yom Tov. So he tried to toe a line between Zimun, Minyan, Yom Tov. That's not our religion. It's not our religion, but you're Jews. And therefore you're treated with respect, you're treated with truthfulness, you're treated with peace and justly in all ways. It's easy to say, difficult to do. He was a forceful personality, obviously, the Rambam, and eventually worked. By the time he dies, you have almost nothing left of the Karaite community. Small little pockets that remain. They eventually move into the lands of Ashkenaz, and they remain there. As I mentioned, Hitler still is dealing with it. There are Karaite communities which were wiped out in World War II. There are Karaite communities which still exist in Israel today. So what does that have to do with Cholent? Almost got it in. Almost forgot Cholent. The Baal HaMaor, one of the early Rishonim, writes that because the Karaites held that you were not allowed to have a fire lit from before Shabbos, they had no candles in their home, and they also therefore would not have any hot food, because in order to have hot food on Shabbos, you have to have had a fire lit from before Shabbos, and you have to have some type of chamin, cholent, whatever word you want to use, a stew that you can leave over a fire to have hot food. If you lived, again, 40% of Egyptian Jewry was Karaites. It spreads through significant parts of the Jewish world. If you didn't eat cholent on Shabbos, says the Baal HaMaor, you are by definition suspect of being a Karaite. By definition, you laugh. Because in today's day and age, not having cholent just means you don't like it. It's a little bit too heavy for you, you're not interested. Makes the house hot. If there were times in our history, if you did not have hot food on Shabbos afternoon, you were literally suspect of a Karaite, and you would not count in the minyan. The Rambam would not count you in the minyan. You say, why? Because you don't have chamin, because you're a Karaite. You say, I'm not a Karaite. You are a Karaite. Why don't you have hot food? It doesn't work. I don't like it. It didn't work in that time period. And every generation, there are different things in which the Jewish world is, you know, the stakes are claimed on certain issues. So the Baal HaMaor writes, and when the early Rishonim in 11, 12, 1300s, in that period, that became part of the Jewish tradition, and it has maintained it. It is part, so people joke about it now, it is literally a part of Jewish life today, because it says, I believe that when the Torah says, Lo sivaru esh, you may not kindle a fire, it is as the oral law tradition teaches us, you may not light a fire on Shabbos. I am establishing my belief in the oral law by lighting a fire before Shabbos and eating my hot food on Shabbos, and that has become part of Jewish life. There is a piece, I don't believe it was actually true, I think it was done tongue-in-cheek, in which a fellow in Israel had a guest over for Shabbos who said he didn't like cholent, and so he declined to eat any, so he had a whole question in his mind if he was allowed to bench, because he wasn't really sure, because he had learned in yeshiva that there was a time in our period where if you didn't eat cholent, you're questionable. But it was part of Jewish life. And it's still today which you find the concept of having hot food on Shabbos, because that was not done in the Karaite world. It was specifically not done in the Karaite world to prove a point, and the rabbinic world said, that's how we keep Shabbos, and that is the authentic Torah life that we have, and that's where cholent came in. It was a response to this controversy of the Karaites. So if you think it doesn't apply today, the next time you go to a house without cholent, yeah. that's the story of the Karaites. Again, they're still around today. And the challenges that they have, the idea of the autonomy of the individual, my ability to interpret it the way I want to, I don't have to listen to anyone's interpretation. Those thoughts, those sentiments still exist, they're still alive and well. Why do I have to listen to the rabbis? Why do I have to listen to rabbinic law? Those concepts still exist, and that's why we study the great controversies that have existed in Jewish history, and the fact that Torah Judaism has survived and flourishes today is because of the traditions that we have in the oral law that we are a big part of. Next week, Mirtz Hashem, I'll be teaching again. We'll be doing the Ashkenaz-Svardi divide at the end of this period that we're at right now. Starting in about the year 1000, the Jewish community splits, and we'll start from there as to how these two different communities developed and in what ways they developed in their different ways. Look forward to seeing you next Monday night.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.